Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
Among the 40,000 or more tablets and other inscribed objects in my collection at Yale, none, I think, has stirred the public imagination as much as the three tablets inscribed with recipes.
Well, fortunately, they were the inventors of writing, and they wrote, fortunately, on clay tablets, which are very durable. You can break it, but you cannot destroy it, and then you absolutely go at it with a sledge.
Ancient cultures, this week on Soundings. William Hallow of Yale University discusses the cuisine of ancient Mesopotamia. Following that, Torkild Jacobsen of Harvard University discusses the language and literature of the Sumerians. William Hallow is professor of Assyriology and Babylonian literature at Yale University, where he also serves as curator of Yale's collection of Babylonian tablets. Here is William Hallow.
Let me try to give you a picture of the tablets on which they're inscribed. I've found that people, especially without the aid of visual medium, sometimes have the impression that the ancient Mesopotamians went around dragging texts behind them in the form of the Flintstones. These are relatively small-sized tablets. Mm-hmm. Probably the biggest of them is not as large as an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, and the smallest considerably smaller. But nevertheless, among them, they contain a rich variety of recipes. The largest number of them is on a tablet which is, according to its summary, filled with 21 meat recipes and 4 for vegetarian dishes. The other two actually have, in one case, even more lines of text, 260 some lines of text on the second of these three tablets. But in this case, the recipes are described in much greater detail, running to 30 or 40 or even more lines each.
This was also a cuisine that was intended, what, for the kings and the priests? This is not the sort of thing that would be the equivalent of, food for the masses, so to speak, in the ancient world.
Exactly. Assuredly, the average diet was far below the rich standards that are revealed by these recipes. Part of their fascination for us, in fact, lies in the observation that here is a veritable succession of banquets that is being prepared for what must have been aristocratic or even royal patrons.
Well, what is the substance of these recipes? What was an ancient elite dinner like? What did it consist of?
It consisted of meats and spices of all varieties, thoroughly simmered and prepared, carved or put to the knife, as the recipes said, and then presented to the diners, whoever they were. We're not clued in as to that, but if we compare the diet of the average man, and even more so of the average woman, we know that it was barely above the subsistence level. We know that from other texts by the hundreds and even the thousands, which detail the rations that the great organizations, such as temple and palace, paid out to those who worked for them.
Now, these ancient recipes that you're describing, Bill Hallow, are far more sophisticated. That again is part of what emerges from these tablets. They're more sophisticated aesthetically and in terms of nutrition, the substance of these ancient meals than we stereotypically would think. Have I got that right?
Absolutely. And again, let me draw the contrast. The subsistence ration of the people working not for money but for meals at the temples and palaces, typically in the outgoing third millennium and early second millennium were limited to the basic staples, including, in above all, barley, of which they got the equivalent of about 2 liters per day or 60 per month.
Goodness.
If they were adult males, half that. If they were women, a fourth of that if they were children. Huh. In addition to barley, which was the great staple of the Mesopotamian, lower Mesopotamian economy at that time, they would regularly given beer rations, but beer again was typically made from barley, which was simply left to ferment at the bottom of a vat filled with water and to which some malt had been added. Sometimes they didn't even bother to take it out of the vat, but drank it by long straws right out of the vat.
And just as a footnote here, Bill Hallow, beer was not just beer. There were many varieties of beer in the ancient...
It was barley beer, but occasionally dates were used to create beer. And the northern part of the country, in what later became Assyria, there was also wine that was grown in the sunny, hilly flanks of the Zagros Mountains. But in addition to beer and barley, there was oil, probably sesame oil most often. Hmm. There was fish, both salt and freshwater fish were caught in tremendous quantities and widely consumed. And then, not to forget the other needs of the average person, wool or finished cloth was often also issued as a ration, and a substance called naga, which we're not sure of the translation of, but which was probably a kind of alkali product intended for soap. Now, if that was the subsistence rations on which the average semi-free laborer lived, then take by contrast this kind of a recipe for a piece of poultry, not entirely identified, so we'll call it by its Akkadian name, taru bird. Meat from fresh leg of mutton is needed. You set water, you throw fat in it, you dress the taru bird, coarse salt as needed, halt cake of malt, onions, something called samidu, which may be a kind of semolina, leek, garlic, milk. You squeeze them, then after cutting up the taru birds, you plunge them in the stock, that is the water, take that from the crock, in order for them to begin cooking in the cauldron. Finally, you place them back in the crock and then bring them out to the knife, that is, for carving, and serve them.
Mm-hmm. I see in both of these pieces that you are using, Bill Hallow, to describe the cuisine of ancient Mesopotamia. For example, that the ancient Mesopotamians loved their food cooked in what amounted to fat. But yes. they were not big with respect to the use of salt. There's an interesting contrast to our diet today.
They did use salt. Salt appears frequently, but I should add that salt was not normally used as a preservative, but as a flavor inducer. Now, preservation played a major role in the Mesopotamian diet and in the Mesopotamian scene, given the enormously high temperatures at which most of the country has to endure most of the year. Notably, for example, something like fish had to be consumed as soon as caught, or it would spoil in the hot sun. Uh-huh. But there was at least one favorite technique for preservation, and that was smoking. So that, in my opinion at least, though some of my colleagues differ with me on this, there is a variety of fish called smoked fish. But there was, in fact, a lively business of preservation that helped extend the range of available foods and their shelf life, as it were. And I won't exclude salt entirely in the process, because in the late period, for example, we read of a freak birth on one of the farms of the South being preserved by being pickled in brine so that it could be studied by the scholars who devoted themselves to such evidences as means for divining the future.
Now, when you say a freak birth, are we talking about a human being or are we talking about
an animal?
Okay. Right.
Yes.
Bill Hallow, let me bring you back to the diet of the ancient Mesopotamians. Do we know anything about did they have a sweet tooth? Desserts, that sort of thing? You mentioned earlier dates and figs, that kind of stuff. Help me to understand that.
Certainly they understood the concept of sweet, because the very word for sweet is used at the same time to express the idea of good. So that which is good is sweet, and vice versa. Hmm. But I will give you another end of the spectrum of the diet, the question of meat. We've talked about poultry, but not of meat on the hoof, so to speak. Admittedly, this must have been an exceptional element in the Mesopotamian diet. It is clear that the average man could aspire to eat meat only on those occasions when there was a religious festival, when meat was slaughtered, sometimes in enormous quantity, in connection with sacrifices. And the way in which this was typically done was to present the slaughtered animal at the table of the deity. And the deity was represented by a carved, sculptured statue, which at least beginning towards the end of the third millennium was in human guise and usually seated. Then the curtains were drawn, the priests retired, and when they opened the curtain again, they went in to see how much the deity had eaten. And being a statue, I can assure you it was always very little, and how much the deity had deigned to leave over, and that which was left over, which was in effect all of it, was then available for distribution to the priesthood themselves and ultimately to the multitude waiting outside. We actually have records of income and disbursements from the great temples, which show that the two were in absolute balance.
In sync.
Right. So that we can assume that it was on the occasion of the great religious festivals that even the common man and perhaps woman could occasionally hope for a cut of meat.
Mm-hmm.
One element we've overlooked is the question of fruits. I've already mentioned dates in connection with the making of drinks, but dates were important in their own right. Figs, by contrast, were common only in the north of the country again. Apples and pears, among other items that were sufficiently common in the diet so that you could even name your son or daughter after them. Shalurum or Shalurtum, for example, little pear, was a favorite name given to children. My teacher, the late I.J. Galb of Chicago, used to disparage those of his colleagues who worked exclusively in the field of literature. He preferred to work with the realia, the texts and the great thousands, which told of the concerns of the common man. And in particular, he was attracted to an archive of cuneiform texts at Philadelphia dealing, of all things, with onions. And so he coined the phrase onionology to describe what he liked to do best. And he summed it all up by saying, "We'll never know what was the nectar and ambrosia of the gods of Mesopotamia until we've reconstructed the fare of the common man." Now, what these three texts from Yale provide us with is the best of both worlds. Here we see real food, but fit for a king.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation featuring William Hallow of Yale University. William Hallow serves as curator of Yale's Babylonian Collection. During a recent fellowship year at the center, William Hallow worked on a project entitled The Origins of Modern Institutions in the Ancient Near East. Soundings on Ancient Cultures continues. My guest now is Torkild Jacobsen of Harvard University. Torkild Jacobsen is working on an introduction to Sumerian, a language that flourished in what is now southern Iraq between the 5th and 2nd millennia before Christ. Let's talk about Sumerian, Torkild Jacobsen. What did it sound like, for example? There are no Sumerians around, I take it, to talk to us these days.
That is the trouble. And the writing is so imperfect that although we pretend that we can write it and therefore presumably read it, I think that no Sumerian could possibly have understood us. It is, think about trying to pronounce English if you didn't know the language, but only have to reconstruct it from the way it is written, the spelling.
Oh, my goodness.
Sumerian is even worse than that.
Now, I don't mean to be impertinent, Torkild Jacobsen, but when you talk about Sumerian with your colleagues at Harvard University, Do you speak this language, or do you simply talk about this language?
Oh, of course, we quote. the way that we transcribe it.
Uh-huh.
And while the Sumerian might have difficulties, my colleagues and I will understand each other. I remember Sam Kramer some 20 years ago, 15 years ago, when we went to scholarly meetings. After the meetings, we would usually have a beer and talk about our problems. And of course, we would spout long passages in our Sumerian that we remembered. And people at the neighboring tables were really in a fit. They couldn't figure out what language these two people were speaking.
How do you say, let's have a beer in Sumerian?
I really don't know, but I can tell you what the name for beer was. That was Kash.
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 All right. For example, let me stop you, yeah. Torkel Jacobsen. For example, does Sumerian have what a counterpart, an analogy in the way we construct English sentences? We think, for example, subject, verb, predicate, that kind of thing. Is that help to understand Sumerian to talk in those terms?
Very, very much so.
Mm-hmm.
We say, into the good house, the first into and then good and then house. In Sumerian, it's the same, only it's reversed. So you said house, good into.
Uh-huh. Were the Sumerians more or less sophisticated when it comes to language than we are in the modern world? By that I mean human nature doesn't change that much, and yet human languages have these wonderful variations to them. Help me to understand that.
It would depend on what kind of sophistication you have in mind.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, the modern world is very complex, and there are technical terms that Sumerian would not have.
In physics, for example.
In physics.
Uh-huh.
But when it comes to human relations, in law, contracts, and in the psychology of their poetry, they understand fully well, for instance, the subtleties of love, the love that is essentially selfish and need love, and the love that is unselfish. And I often marvel at the insights that these people had in human behavior.
Well, give me a couple of examples, Torkel Jacobsen, of Sumerian poetry. For instance, the one that you have before you here is a hymn, you tell me.
This is a
hymn. To the goddess of what? The goddess of morning?
Morning and evening star. Here, she is the goddess of the evening star.
What does this sound like? Tell me.
Well, this is translation, of course.
Uh-huh.
The evening star, the brilliantly rising star, shedding great light over holy heaven, the queen, the evening star, has seen fit to come forth on high, warrior-like in the sky. And in all lands, the people are lifting up their faces toward her. The man is cheering up, the woman is brightening, the ox in its yoke is turning the head homewards. Sheep and goats, shuffling back, make the dust settle thick in their folds. The numerous wild goats and asses of Shakan, the animals of the desert, the far-flung, four-footed beasts, the orchard pits, the garden pits, the green canebrake, the fish of the deep, the birds of heaven, my lady, is making wind their way to their lairs. All living beings, the numerous people, are bending knees to her. Called by my lady, the old women are providing plentifully for great eating and drinking. Then my lady calms down everything in her country, the playgrounds of the nation, the holiday makers, and the young knight holds converse with the wife heart to heart. From heaven's midst, milady looks kindly down. Before holy Inanna, before her eyes, they walk. August is the queen, the evening star in the sky, Inanna. Fitly, therefore, they praise the maiden Inanna. August is the queen, the evening star in the sky, unto the borders of heaven.
This sounds very concrete. The Sumerians had a very specific sense of the physical world about them.
Yes, also they had a great sense of the power that they felt in nature.
Is it unfair of us to call them superstitious?
I don't know. I would not. I would say they were religious.
Uh-huh.
Maybe they were as so human as to misdirect, to seek concreteness, where misplaced concreteness.
Is there a hierarchy of gods and goddesses? I take it that this is a polytheistic culture.
Yes, there is. The highest god was the god of the sky. Mm-hmm. And then came the god of the storms, but also the god who ruled the world, who was behind all great political and other events, and also the one who took care of all humanity.
What about their political rhetoric, Torkel Jacobsen? Have we matured?
In a way, we have returned to where the Sumerians began, because the earliest records we have shows that they had developed a primitive democracy where all the members of society would get together and make decisions about choosing their leaders, both in war and in economics, and also would serve as a court, a high court for great court cases.
Why is Sumerian important to scholarship today, Torkel Jacobsen? You have spent years of your life reading it, translating it, yeah, digging it up, putting it together.
I would say it's important in so many respects. It's important for the linguist because it's another example of a different kind of language. It is important to the historian because it's the beginning of Near Eastern and, in fact, a Western civilization. It is important to the historian of laws because the laws, famous laws of Hammurabi, go back to Sumerian prototypes. In fact, it's most of them are directly translated from Sumerian. And it is important for the political scientist because it shows the early forms of political life. I mentioned democracy. Mm-hmm. It shows how democracy gives way to monarchy and to one-man rule, so that at the end of Mesopotamian civilization, in the conflict between Greece and Persia, the Orient stands for tyranny and Greece for democracy. But that was the sorry end product of something that began very, very nicely with democracy.
Of a civilization that had flourished long before that. What about, before our taping, you mentioned to me that women are particularly important. Help me to tease that out, not necessarily in terms of the Sumerian language, but the Sumerian culture. Yes. What did you have in mind?
It is extraordinary, the equality of the sexes. Hmm. That you find in Sumerian. We had ruling queens. The Sumerians had women that were head of large business undertakings with their own and ran in their own name. It was possible for a woman to divorce a husband if he was unfaithful or for some other reason she did not feel that he treated her rightly. And this equality comes out very nicely in the language because Sumerian has the same term for husband and wife. Hmm. They are both spouse. If you have to be very special, you can say male spouse and female spouse. They have one term for children. You can say a female child or a male child. But It's very, very different from the Semitic languages that followed it, Assyrian and Babylonian. There, the name for the husband is the same as the one for Lord and the one for owner.
Aha, here's where these distinctions
begin. So there was a real difference that came about there.
Thorkell Jacobsen, let's conclude our conversation about Sumerian. How does one say goodbye, ladies and gentlemen, in Sumerian?
I wish I knew, but let us say, Chay Silim, may it be for the good.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation featuring Thorkell Jacobsen of Harvard University. During a recent fellowship year at the center, Thorkell Jacobsen worked on an introduction to Sumerian. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 477. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Here's news for high school teachers. From mid-June through early July of 1990, the National Humanities Center will sponsor two enrichment programs for high school teachers of literature and history. Participants will receive travel, lodging, and a stipend of $750. For an application, write to Summer Institutes, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, Teachers on Teaching, conversations with four participants in the Center's 1989 Summer Institutes for High School Teachers. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. This week marks birthdays for three American presidents, Zachary Taylor in 1784, Franklin Pierce in 1804, and James Garfield in 1831. Abraham Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address during mid-November 1863. 74 years before that, New Jersey became the first state to ratify 10 of the proposed 12 amendments to the United States Constitution. These 10 amendments came to be known as the Bill of Rights. Other mid-November birthdays include Chester Gould, the creator of Dick Tracy, born in 1900, the French philosopher Voltaire, born in mid-November 1694, the English novelist Marianne Evans, born in 1819, Hetty Green, reported to be the richest woman in 19th century America, born in mid-November 1835, and Scott Joplin, the American composer famous for his piano rags, born in mid-November 1868. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Ancient Cultures, this week on Soundings. William Hallow, curator of the Babylonian Tablet Collection at Yale University, discusses the cuisine of the ancient Near East. Thorkell Jacobsen of Harvard University discusses the language and literature of the Sumerians, a people that flourished between the 5th and 2nd millennia before Christ. The cuisine and the literature of antiquity, this week on Soundings.